Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, he's probably the most controversial director working in films today. But why? The Movie Geeks chat with Uwe Boll, plus the director of the new film Numb, starring Matthew Perry, Mr. Harris Goldberg, and author Christopher Keane tells us all about his new book, Romancing the A-List. It is all coming up next on Movie Geeks Unite.
Hi, here's Uwe Boll, and I have a statement to make about that internet petition. There's a petition out, Stop Uwe Boll, and I said, like, if there are 1 million people on that petition, I stop actually making movies. And I want that there's a petition also out there, like a pro Boll petition, and I expect 1 million votes pro Boll. And I hope somebody would set it up and you all start signing it. Because, look, I'm not a fucking retard like Michael Bay or other people running around in that business, or Eli Roth making the same shitty movies over and over again. If you really look in my movies, you will see my real genius, you know? And if you go on May 23 in Postal, you will see that I deliver a movie what nobody else delivered in the last 10 years. What is way better as all that social critic George Clooney bullshit what you get every fucking weekend. So you have to really wake up and you have to see me what I am. I'm the only genius in the whole fucking business. Goodbye.
Strong words from a very strong-willed director, Mr. Uwe Boll, is going to join us in just a few seconds. This is Movie Geeks United, and I'm one of your co-hosts for the evening. My name is Jamie, and Jerry is here with us too. Hey, man.
Hey, what's up? I love the new theme music. That was awesome.
It is great theme music, and we're going to talk about that at length after this opening segment. We finally got ourselves some new theme music.
It's just like a trillion times better. I mean,
yeah, and it sounds you know, like we're an official movie show now.
Yes, it does. Great?
Isn't it amazing the production value that adds to our show automatically? So yeah, I'm excited to talk about that. You know, we just got through with our 1 year anniversary show. That was last week. It was an enormous success, and we thank everyone for all of your emails and phone calls and correspondences, and we were very touched by all of your support out there.
Yes, we were. Thank you.
And we have a great show for you tonight. You guys, you ready to get started?
Yes, I am.
Let's do it. We begin our show tonight with Uwe Boll. After receiving a doctorate in literature in 1995, Boll embarked on his filmmaking career. He's perhaps most notable for directing a series of films based on popular video games, including Alone in the Dark, House of the Dead, Blood Rain 1 and 2, and In the Name of the King, a dungeon siege tale, all films that revel in cinematic escapism. He's worked with some exceptional talents along the way, including actors like Jason Statham, Burt Reynolds, Ray Liotta, and Ben Kingsley. And he's one of the most prolific writers, producers, directors in the business, with no less than 6 more films in the pipeline for the future. And his latest film, Postal, awaiting its U.S. release on May 23rd, a film that Dread Central calls bloody, unflinching, and uproarious fun. So why is Uwe Boll considered one of our most controversial film directors? A recent petition was established to either end or save Boll's career, and anti-Boll sentiment has spread across the web like a virus. The movie geeks want to hear from the man himself on the controversy that surrounds him, and of course, his new film Postal, which by all accounts is his ballsiest and most outrageously controversial film yet. It's a great pleasure to welcome Uwe Boll to our program. Mr. Boll, are you there?
Yeah, hi. Hi. How are you?
Welcome.
Hi. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. It's a great pleasure to have you on.
No problem.
Now, this petition got started a couple of weeks ago, and you know, I have my own feelings about it. But when you first heard about it, what was your take on this?
No, the petition to stop me is 2.5 years old.
Oh, is it?
And what? Yeah, and it was like 2 years already out there, and they had like 10,000 or 15,000 votes. And where I said in an interview, the whole thing that I maybe stop if there is 1 million signatures on it. Then this went out to the websites, to the press, and since then, like there are now 200,000 votes on that anti-ball petition. And to defend myself, I said, look, why there is not a pro-ball petition also there?
Right.
And I get every day emails from people that hate my movies, but I get also every day emails from people that love my movies. So, and I said,
sure.
Like, why are only the ball haters so good organized? You should do a pro-ball petition. And now it turned out there are like 6 or 7 pro-ball petitions, what is actually not good because
right.
the votes are like spread out over like 7 different petitions now.
Right,
yeah,
right.
It's funny that you say that because I just received an email from a listener today that started a pro-ball petition. And I was thinking the exact same thing. It needs to be a unified, you know, one single front for you. But it doesn't it just seem... silly. I mean, I see this petition. I just think it's a bunch of bullshit. I just don't understand where these people are coming from. Why are they vilifying you this way?
No, I think because I started with that video game based movies, House of the Dead, and then I kept doing it with Alone in the Dark and Blood Rain and Dungeon Siege and Postal in a way that especially that internet. Affine
right.
people like basically went off on me and flipped completely out. I don't know. It is kind of absurd because if you see the movies, I don't think that the movies are so embarrassing that you can move into a completely hated, like hating mood against me. I don't
right.
know what it is. But there's another thing. I think what was heating everything up in the last few years. I'm not like. Integrated in that Hollywood system, and I say what I think, and like if somebody let me down, like whatever, Christian Slater and Alone in the Dark was a great guy to shoot with, but then when it came down to promote the movie, he did nothing, and I told him that he's an asshole because if he gets a paycheck and makes a movie and he is the lead. He should do something for the movie, and
yeah, it's his responsibility.
Yeah, why sign on to do it? I mean,
exactly. And it was his last big movie where he was the lead. Let's face it, he plays since then only a supporting act, right? So, and I think
right.
this was his chance to get back. And Lionsgate made a 2000 print release, and then of course Jay Leno or Letterman or whatever, they're not inviting me; they're inviting Christian Slater.
Sure.
And he did it. And Jason Statham did the same now on In the Name of the King Dungeon Siege. And I think this is unfair, especially
yeah.
if you tell me that, first of all, you like me, and second of all, you like the movie, and I had no indication that a Jason Statham or whatever didn't like In the Name of the King, for example. You know. And this is the thing. I think this is also fake. And I cannot stand that Hollywood mentality. Because what happens is, they're getting wrong advices from managers, from agents, and all the actors are, like, pussying out. You know, it's like that actors, even if they play heroes, are very, let's say, small-minded people, very selfish, or only about themselves, and they don't see the big picture, basically. The big picture is if a movie like Dungeon Siege fails, the value of Jason Statham as an actor goes down, and he gets
right.
less money
right.
for his next movies. They think they can get away with it if they don't support the movie. But this is only a thing, and I think a lot of wannabe filmmakers or whatever flipping out on me because of that.
Mm.
You know, I don't know. Maybe they feel like that I'm basically that I was in the same situation like the guy sitting in Denver and he wants to make movies. And I was
right.
in the same situation, right? I had nothing to do with the film industry. My parents have nothing to do with the film industry. And I didn't get any money from my parents, so I had to work my ass off to make movies. And this is what I mean. I think this is what they hate even more if there's an outsider coming in.
Yeah, this is kind of where we stand on this here on the show. Obviously, it's struggle enough to be a working filmmaker, and you are a working filmmaker. I mean that's achievement enough. So if you don't like the movies, just don't go see them. I just think it's very, very kind of fake, and a fake way to vilify someone by mounting these kind of campaigns. But what I find very endearing about you is that you're very, in some interviews that I've heard, you're very open about how you feel that you've grown as a director throughout your career. I mean, starting with maybe Alone in the Dark onto some of your latest works. How do you assess your own growth as a director?
No, I think, look, everything what you do is try and error, and everything what you do is also experience. And this is for everything. If you cook every day for yourself, you will see how you improve as a cook.
Right.
Or if you play squash every day, you will get better. And as a director, I think that if you don't do it, you cannot learn it. You cannot learn to be a director if you read books about movies or if you see movies. And there's a big difference between like sitting at home or making like small short movies with the kids in the neighborhood. What I started also with, and I was sitting also, there was 15, 16, 17 writing scripts and scripts and scripts, and no script could ever bought or sold or whatever. And then later, if you actually start making movies, I think it helped me totally that in my first movies I had to do everything. I even did the camera, and you get a feeling for like light and whatever. And then if you have the chance at one point, you have a little more money for a movie, you have better crew, you learn from the crew. You see how my first movie, 1999 in Canada, what I shot, Sanctimony, with Casper Van Dien, was like for me a very, very big experience, like not my language. And then the bigger crews here in America compared to Germany, and all that stuff. And it would be like totally absurd to say I know everything from the beginning on, and I don't get better. And I think if you see movies like House of the Dead, Alone in the Dark, and then later now In the Name of the King, or Postal, or Seed, my horror movie, I think you see that they are so much better compared to Blackwoods or House of the Dead or Alone in the Dark. And what is for me really bad, and I cannot believe it actually, that these guys are out there, and every movie what gets out gets like voted with 1 point on IMDb, and a lot of normal journalists, like, of course they research me online, and then in all the interviews I don't talk about my movies, I talk about my reputation. And this is in a way boring, especially if you have some movies like A Postal or Seed or my Vietnam War movie what comes up, 1968, what are interesting movies with interesting stories and interesting like controversial scenes also. So,
well, I am going to be one of those guys that wants to ask you about those films. We're definitely going to talk about those films that you have upcoming, including Postal, which I'm anxious to see. Do you feel like this business doesn't kind of allow you the opportunity to grow? I mean, do you feel that with all this press you could make the next Citizen Kane and it wouldn't be recognized as such?
Absolutely. I think there's a point what if you feel like where I did Postal, and look, I see movies like you every week, a few movies, and I see direct-to-DVD movies, I see the theatrical movies, and I follow really up what is out there. And the point is that I think with Postal, I was able, and maybe this was also based on my frustration I had after Blood Rain tanked in the U.S. theaters and got the same bad reviews like House of the Dead or Alone in the Dark. I was sitting down, like after 7, 8 years, and wrote a script where I put all my energy, all my hate, all my humor, all the like frustration about what the world is and what situation the world is, with not only the global warming, whatever, also Osama and Bush and the corruption in politics and the Iraq war. And I combined it with that video game story that we have, that postal dude living in a trailer park with a 500-pound girl wife. And I think, because of this, I cannot get lower in the rankings of the critics. That right. I really gave a shit about everything, and I wrote that movie in a way that it's that it turned out, I think, really funny and important. And this is the thing, like, even if it's an absurd comedy and it starts with the September 11 pilots and everything, and it comes around like a dirty kind of comedy, I think it nails the situation in the situation we're living in
right.
way better. As this was, look, I like George Clooney, and even if I gave him shit in the... Because the point is, no, you know why I said that statement? Is because I think there is something, like, if for example, if George Clooney is doing something, and around him, of course, is Steven Soderbergh and Matt Damon and all the political, people sitting in Hollywood and making this kind of movies like Serrani or whatever, they're getting from the beginning on critical acclaim, no matter what it is. And even if it's not good, or even it's not really... reflecting the real political situation. And I think in Postal, where I show that Osama and Bush doing together insurance fraud, and Osama was never in Afghanistan, he lives in Tucson, Arizona, and this total absurd situation I think I show in Postal is maybe way closer to the reality.
Well, that's
all
that
super serious stuff, what comes like stop loss here, and here's the next Iraq war drama with people coming back home of the brave. I think this is everything what comes from the studios in regard of the Iraq war is totally failing the point.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is interesting, and we're jumping around a little bit, but you've brought this into the fold. You know, you've mentioned these other kinds of films that deal with political and social issues that play it very straight. Is there a benefit of using satire, as you have with Postal, that kind of brings about more profound truths than if you would have played it straight? Are you
Absolutely.
Able to go further?
Yeah, this is the thing. Like, you can be way harsher, and you can say some stuff what you couldn't do in a serious movie. And I think the biggest important thing is to take it serious, to take Postal serious, even if it's an absurd comedy.
Right.
Because, look, if you at one point, we all have to wake up and we have to say, okay, the world is not in a situation the world should be. And if you see, take Obama, for example. He said a few weeks ago, like, it's absurd that the people still have weapons in America and that they are so religious driven, right? And since he said that, he's excusing every day in public that he said that. But the reality is that he said the truth. And it's time to wake up and to tell the people, if it's fundamentalist Muslims, if it's like Bible Belt Jesus Camp people from the Middle West, it is time to say, as a knowledge educated person living in this century now, look, guys, you are wrong. There is evolution. There is Darwin. And it's not like if you're an ultra-Orthodox Jew running around with a fucking black head and a big beard and stuff coming down out of your hair. Like, it's your problem. You are retarded. You think the wrong things about the world. You are wrong. And
right.
We are scientific-driven and natural science-driven. And this is also not, we cannot explain everything, but we know what is wrong. And we know that what Bush thinks about the evolution and the people in Midwest America think in the Jesus camps, whatever, that they are wrong. And they shouldn't have any political power, and they shouldn't vote at all as long they think this kind of things, what is proven wrong. So, and I think we are living in a time where it's time to step up, to say about Bush, for example, look, the Iraq war is a money-driven war made by Halliburton, Dick Cheney, and Bush, in paid by the weapon industry. And they made everything up about weapons of mass destruction and connections Al-Qaeda, Saddam, to start that idiotic war to make more money for their buddies. And it's not something good that there are soldiers and everybody like McCain or whatever say every day, like, you work for your country in Iraq. No, it's wrong. It's wrong that they're in Iraq. And if you're a soldier in Iraq, you should pack your stuff and go home, because you shouldn't fight for people that make money on you. You are not fighting in Iraq for America. You're fighting because you are cheated in a war and you maybe lose your life there. Why? Because people want to get richer. So, and all that stuff, you know, and this is the point. Like, I studied economy, I studied literature. And to think because I did House of the Dead that I'm not so educated like a George Clooney if he makes a movie. I would bet with you that I'm way more educated and I read way more stuff about as George Clooney his whole life. You know, I'm a doctor of literature. And this
right.
is pissing me off, that I'm in a situation that I look like a retard from that guy's, written down from that guy's in the internet, but it's not myself. And this is the whole point why I think it's time that serious critics start looking in that what I did as a filmmaker, starting with German Fright Movie or Barschel Murder in Geneva, what is a semi-documentary about a dead prime minister in Germany, or Heart of America, the movie about school violence. Why nobody sees that movies and starts writing about that movies? Every movie from a Michael Haneke or Tom Tykwer gets like followed up to the roots and interpretations here, interpretations there. And the people don't see that I did way more movies as this guy and more and totally different movies. And I, don't get me wrong, I like movies from Tom Tykwer. I like movies from Michael Haneke. So, and
I know what you're saying.
Yeah,
I know exactly what you're saying.
But it sounds have been movies about like the school shootings and everything. There are a couple coming out in the next couple months.
Yeah, but look, when I did that, I did Heart of America 2002 about the school shootings, you know? And what I didn't get any attention because in the same year, Elephant came up with Gus Van Sant's school shooting.
Yeah, I know, and then he overshadows you because that won the award at Cannes, so...
Yeah.
Right.
So, and there's the thing, but is that the reason to ignore that movie if you judge me as a filmmaker? You know, and this is the point, and I'm... And I think coming back to Postal, I think Postal is made in that totally free spirit that there are no rules. There is no religion. There is no nation. There is no race difference. We are all humans. And this is what in every single scene in Postal, it's kind of anarchistic. And I think this is the thing why I'm totally convinced from Postal that it's the right movie at the right time to make this point.
Do you feel like this is a turning point for you, that this could be the most important film you've made thus far in your career?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. Yeah. And I'm sure Postal is a movie, even if maybe a lot of people were not getting it now, I don't know. But if we talk again in 15 years, I'm 100% sure that Postal is a classic. Because nobody made a movie like this since September 11. And before that, you had movies like Life of Brian or whatever, really good movies from Monty Python, for example. And all that kind of movies disappeared. It's not, nobody would give Monty Python money anymore. And I think this is a big problem, what this kind of comedies we're having, this kind of movies we're having. It's a little dangerous that it's like one-sided only. And I think Postal is a movie what has a... it's not only funny, it's also, in a way, a must-see.
Right. Excuse me, Dr. Bull, I read an article yesterday on the AP that does it bother you, though, that they're lumping Postal in as just a comedy about 9/11? Does that bother you? They're putting it in the same category with the new Harold and Kumar comedy. Does it bother you?
No, I can look. As long as I get any press about it.
Yeah, it's the first. I mean, I think you'd be mainstream press is finally talking about your movie in, let's be very blunt here, very positive terms. Even though no, there haven't been any reviews of it that I've read in the mainstream press, there are people actually talking about this movie like it is something to go check out.
Right.
And I have not seen that before with your movies in at least the United States.
No, absolutely, and I think that this is the first positive thing, and I'm sure that I will still have a hard time with Postal to get enough screens. Like in Canada, Pisage is releasing it, and in U.S. I do it together with Vivendi, and the exhibitors are not behind Postal, so. Like what I mean behind means like, are they showing a lot of trailers in the theaters? Did you walk in the theater and there is a big poster hanging? No. because they hang every on every corner is Indiana Jones and Speed Racer and Iron Man. So you have to overcome, like, the problem is that the audience must come up on May 23 for Postal without that there was before that super massive advertising campaign, like for a big studio movie. So, and I hope that they will come up on May 23, they will check out where the movie is running, and then they will go there. And I hope that there will be a word of mouth about the movie.
Did you want, I mean, wouldn't you, that release date, as you know, is, you're going against the elephant in the room is Indiana Jones that weekend.
I know, but it's good, because the reality is, I'm follow up what's going on in the theatrical business. And for me, to start on a weekend where Indiana Jones starts on the Wednesday, and on the Friday where Postal comes out, is no other movie coming out.
True.
And I prefer this compared to you get on a weekend where like four medium movies getting out,
mm-hmm.
but each movie gets 2,000 screens. Look, last weekend, Forbidden Kingdom, I'm Over Sarah Marshall, or whatever the title was, and 88 Minutes, are three movies. All three went out on 2,500 screens.
Right.
And all three movies spending $20 million or more in advertising. So, and I prefer then to be the totally underdog against maybe the biggest movie of the year, and but at least there is no other competition around me.
Yeah. I actually think that it's great counter-programming. And I've said that before on the show. It's pretty smart sometimes to open up against the
big...
It's very smart.
Definitely counter-programming. Definitely. I remember seeing a trailer for your film back in October.
I know.
In the movie
it was scheduled for November last year.
Yes.
And then what happened was exactly that situation, that more and more movie releases came up, and they moved, like the studios moved movies around, and on our release date were already three bigger releases with 2,500 prints
mm-hmm.
plus. And then we moved it, and we couldn't get into the December thing. And in January was In the Name of the King coming out. So I was like blocking. The plan was, we were thinking about, should we do In the Name of the King later and should we do Postal first? And then, but In the Name of the King was already locked in. And then we kept In the Name of the King for January. And this is the whole point, that it went now, it goes against Indiana Jones May 23. And I actually made the decision. In the beginning, everybody said, no, you cannot do it, you cannot do it. Also in Canada, like PSAG said, are you crazy? And I said, no, this is the best date, because I'm counting also on the following. I think Iron Man will be good and will be a big hit. But Iron Man is starting next week. And I think that Speed Racer and the Narnia 2 movie will actually suck big time. everything what I saw from that movies was crap, totally crap, right? So and I think this is a good chance for us that this movies will be not like that super big massive hits, so that the exhibitors on May 23 have for us room so that we get our 1500 or 1200 screens. This is what we want to go for.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, you mentioned. I want to ask you about film criticism, because we spoke to Paul Schrader a few weeks ago, and he talked about the decline of film criticism. You used to be a film critic back in the '80s, I think, for radio, didn't you?
Yeah, I started as a student where I was in Cologne. A student, I went to different radio stations and did like small film critic things, or I reported about like. Whatever, like for example, I interviewed Bo Derek, where she was with the movie 10 in
right.
promoting and this kind of stuff. So this was stuff where, but as a young guy, this was for me perfect, because I got into the premieres, I saw actors, I saw like I could interview directors and everything. So it was great to get some money for this and to have like free movies.
Right.
Yeah.
But how do you see that film criticism is lacking? I mean, do you really see a lack of proper analyzation? Where are we at now in the film criticism world as you view it?
No, the thing is, I don't want to judge all film critics the same, but I definitely think that there is a kind of a, let's say this way, a lot of film critics, they pussy out in front of the majors. And right. they are like, because they're getting a lot of benefits from the major companies, so they, a lot of times, they don't criticize a movie where they know the guy who's doing the press, where they know the distribution company. In a way, they are not like so harsh they would be to me, for example. Yeah. So and the thing is, for example, In the Name of the King came in Germany out with 20th Century Fox. And then we had that press day in Berlin and Hamburg. And because it was Fox now, and a major big release in Germany, a lot of critics, they trashed me before, like in the garbage can, were very nice. And the reviews of In the Name of the King in Germany were like 50-50, positive, negative. So it was, but it was overall, for me, it's 50-50 already a very good quote. Yeah. And we released Postal in Germany, was totally because I didn't get any screens in Germany. They were all scared of fundamentalists. Mm. And so we released Postal independently in Germany. And I got like 80% totally bad reviews. You know, and Postal is way better in the Name of the King. And the thing is, like, the strange thing with Postal was in the German reviews was all the established bigger newspapers trashed it to the ground. Like, dirty, anti-America, this is, like, ridiculous, and so on, making fun out of September 11 is ridiculous. So they totally tried to destroy it. And but the 20% positive reviews in Germany about the movie were like a masterpiece and better. So absurd it is. But it was a totally range where there were also like a thing like where they asked 20 film critics about the best movie of last year, and the worst movie of last year. And 5 from the 20 reviewers in Germany said Postal was the best movie of the whole year, including No Country for Old Men, There Will Be Blood, all the Oscar movies.
Well, here's something.
But the other 15, from the other 15, 5 said it was under the 3 worst movies they saw last year. So it's totally like dividing the audience.
Well, you screened this in the States for critics. I'm wondering the response from New Yorkers particularly.
Yeah, New York was actually very good. I was surprised. It was 2 weeks ago. I was in New York. I did the screening, and it got very good response. People were laughing. The SSF was super loud in the screening, and I just went. The New York Times interviewed me. They really liked it. So, and then I went to Chicago and did a press screening, and I think New York was way better as Chicago, and but because maybe of the September 11 thing. Because the New Yorkers, I think if you live in New York, you're tired of all that, that you, like a normal New York person, feels guilty in a way that Bush could use that September 11th to start a senseless war. Like under the name of the New York citizens and the victims of September 11th, Bush abused that in a massive way.
Mm.
So, and I think this is what the New Yorkers are not happy with.
Well, the film is Postal. It comes out May 23rd. What's upcoming for you? I know you have five or six films on your slate. You're really busy. What's coming up?
Yeah, I did. Well, I'm still like almost finished with 1968 Tunnel Rats, with the Vietnam War movie where we shot in South Africa with the Blood Diamond crew, and this turns out very good. We had like very young actors from LA going in a boot camp for the movie with like South African mercenaries, and this South African mercenaries, they never trained film people, and they were actually like all fighters from Rwanda and everything. So this was not like the Hollywood boot camp thing. This was like people that just killed people 2 weeks before they did the boot camp, and this was really hard. And these actors turned there in the South African jungle into a totally different state of mind. What was for the movie really good, and the movie is very intense and it's a very depressing war movie about that Kuchi tunnel, this 260 kilometers tunnel system, where the reason why the Viet Cong won the war was that 260 kilometer tunnel system they had. And it's the first movie about this where traps and where you go in the tunnel, you fell in spears, and there are booby traps, you blow like hand grenades hidden and all that stuff. So But everything what happens in the movie happened in real, and I think it's a very good movie. Then my horror movie Seed, what was in a few festivals, will come out on DVD, because we don't have the P&A to release it in the theaters. And I'm very happy with that movie also, because it's also based on, there's an execution on the electric chair, and like in real time, and the movie is a little more as a horror movie. It is basically a little like a nihilistic kind of point of view what humans are. And it's very harsh with the death penalty. Also, I opened the movie with like animal footage where animals getting like skinned alive from, and I got that material from PETA.
Which you donated, your salary to PETA?
Yeah, 2.5% goes to PETA. And it makes a point. It sets a beginning, like, okay, now you're not in Saw here or something like this. The next 90 minutes will be not fun.
Right.
This is why I opened that movie with that, to really make, like, a statement. And no, I'm very happy with Seed. And I just finished a movie. This would be then the last thing, is a movie where Edward Furlong is in and Sam Levinson, the son of Barry Levinson, and a few other guys, about a real case, what happened in a German cell 2 years ago in prison, where three guys basically tortured the guy for 9 hours till he hanged himself. And it's also a movie what, similar to Tunnel Rats, all the actors that even slept in the jail, they went totally in character. And it's like a super hard psycho drama. And everything what happened there happened in reality. And the shocking element of the whole case was, and I went in Germany to the courtroom where the thing happened, is that they were like 20 years old and they were only sitting for minor crimes. So they were sitting there for like drug dealing for 2 years. And now they have all three have lifelong sentences. And so they raped him, they made him eat shit, and so it is like Rwanda or Auschwitz level, you know? It's not like they bullied him around 9 hours till he hanged himself. It is the completely, that people losing their existence without, like, out of nowhere, you know? It's a very disturbing, very hard movie. But
well, these are disturbing movies. Are you looking for anything, any kind of pleasant romantic comedy in your future? Because
no, I'm not really. I would not say I don't do a romantic comedy, but the thing is, I'm personally more interested in things they have like in any way a connection to reality, even
sure.
if it sounds strange from the guy who did House of the Dead or Alone in the Dark. But I really try since Postal, I try to come back to that theme. And next year I plan a movie about the Janjaweed. These are the guys, they're doing the massacres in Sudan, like the genocide basically. And I want to make like a movie, a little like a Hotel Rwanda movie about Sudan, but it will be not like Hotel Rwanda, it will be more like Apocalyptica, like from Mel Gibson. It will be very brutal.
Sure.
And yeah, to say, to make also a statement about that situation, like that it's so absurd that after the massacres in Rwanda 10 years ago, everybody said, like, why nobody stopped it? And now we have the same thing in Sudan since 3-4
sure.
years. We're like 2 million people sitting in Darfur escaping from the Janjaweed.
Right.
I can really recommend that documentary, what is in the video stores, The Devil Came on Horseback. This is about this. But you don't see the massacres.
Right, right.
So, and this is the thing. And I will actually show how a small village will get wiped out and the children getting raped and hacked in pieces. And I think it's necessary to show that, to make clear what, like, why we don't do anything. It's a crime from the NATO and that the NATO states are not stopping it.
Right.
I cannot believe it. And
we actually, in the next week, we have a show dedicated to Darfur, and we're bringing on some filmmakers from that. But in the meantime, Mr. Bull, the time has flown, and it's been a great conversation, and
yes,
I wish
you
the best of luck with Postal, and please come back and join us in the future. We want to hear about future projects when they come
thank
to
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bull.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you, Mr. Bull. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Uwe Boll. His film Postal comes out May 23rd, opening opposite Indiana Jones.
He's eager to take it on.
I tell you what, I am surprised because everything you read in the press, you know, you're ready to take on this guy, and I'm not a combative person anyway. I'm not going to welcome him on the show and combat him.
No, there's no reason to.
But I was hard pressed to find anything in what he said that I disagreed with.
But not only that, he's great. I just let you know, wind him up, and he just went on for another 2 hours. No, I love it. No, he made some very good points.
He's right. He's absolutely right about some of the stuff about the politics in America, and even that comment by Obama that he's mea culping for ever since. You know, he was right.
Oh yeah, I'm not going to disagree with
we're,
that.
We're not paying attraction to the absurdities in this country, and I don't know why people are more outraged. I remember seeing Bill Maher the other night, and he said, "If our president," he was very smart. He said, "If our president were Colonel Sanders, and the price of chicken went up 300%, people would be up in an uproar. You know, they'd know something was going on."
Yeah, I mean,
you know, isn't it obvious?
Yeah,
some of these things.
Yeah, no, it is. No, it was a fascinating interview. I think the petitions are ridiculous.
Yeah,
as most of these things that start on the internet or whatever, I think are, just. There's just much more important things going on in our lives.
And I think, you know, just don't go see his movies if you don't like
them. Yeah, that's what I see. No one is pointing a gun at your head saying you have to go see House of the Dead. You know?
I've seen a couple of his movies. My opinions are tainted by the fact that they're not in my genre. I mean, I don't like video games. I don't generally like movies with the sword and sorcery, dragon movies, or such like that. But even seeing, because I have seen two of his films, I've seen Blood Rain 2 and I saw Alone in the Dark. And I do see a growth in him as a filmmaker that he's being completely honest about.
Right.
You know, and everyone's entitled to that growth. But, and I know Kitten Fist doesn't agree, but, you know, he hasn't seen either of them.
So. Yeah, but Kitten Fist is like, I think he threw a rock at my mailbox last week, so I'm not sure. And then one at me.
Right.
But,
But an interesting interview. Jerry, you had something you actually needed to bring
up.
Yeah,
I do.
And
I
want
good
to talk
friends
about
at Horror Movie Fans Radio have a great show tonight at 10 o'clock. Well, first of all, one of the great things is horroryearbook.com will be co-hosting the show with them. And let me just get the info here for you. Will be one of the co-hosts, if I'm not mistaken. And they will have, I want to get the exact information for everyone. I don't want to give any misinformation tonight. But they will have on Rachel Grubb and Brooke Lemke from Cave Women of Mars on at 10 o'clock. And Will from HorrorYearbook.com will be on there. And so that's going to be a great time.
Yeah, they're in the chat room. They're posting it too. So that's tonight at 10 o'clock.
Yes, 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time.
Oh, okay, I want to talk about something.
Oh, shit.
You heard our opening music.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Now, I think we gave out several hints last week at the one-year anniversary. But, you know, that the Chris and actually all of us are kind of, we were using that music because it was functional, it was there, but it didn't really bring up the best of our show. So, thank goodness, a big fan of our show answered the call, Michael McCormick, and he's a great film composer. He's the composer behind The Shark Is Still Working. One of his works, and we had him on the show previously for the Roy Scheider tribute, and he answered our call.
He's a wonderful human being.
He is a champion, man, and he worked his tail off for long hours trying to get us a theme going, and I was doing it behind you guys' backs because I wanted to surprise you with a brand new theme, you know.
No, hey, dude, it worked. It's beautiful. I really like it.
I played it at 100% last time. I hope the volume was okay. I'm going to play the opening theme music again for everybody to listen to in case you weren't able to get it from the get-go. And here it is. Let's play it.
beautiful.
That's good. That's good. We're an official movie show. We also have new closing music, and we're discussing this because he gave me a piece of music first, and I said, I love it. But it sounds very kind of wistful.
Right.
And it sounds like it could be closing music because I want to. Could you make a festive version of this for the opening? Can't wait for this to start. And then the closing music will be, oh, I'm so sad the show's over. Yeah, so and he came through. I mean, he gave it to us. It was great. So we are waiting our next guest to call in. At the top of the hour, his name is Harris Goldberg. And he's directed a new film called Numb, and it's a great film. Speaking of great films, I saw one last night.
What did you see?
Shine a Light. I saw the Stones, Scorsese movie in IMAX. And it was incredible.
Yeah, it's a great one.
It was everything you and Aaron had talked about last week, and finally tracked it down. We got a couple IMAX screens here, and I would recommend. Did you get to see it in IMAX?
No, I didn't even. It's only downtown in the, and I don't bother for that. I just went to the local theater that did have it, and that was good enough for me.
Right. Well, it's exceptional, especially in IMAX. I would think that would be the format to watch it in IMAX.
No, definitely.
Yeah, because it's a real kind of experience, and I don't think that you can get the same thing, in a regular screen or at home. And the sound design is so incredible, and IMAX is very particular with their presentations. They have to be.
They have to be, but don't they also? Well, it's not. I don't think the movie's not over 2 hours. I don't think it's over 2 hours.
It rests right at 2 hours.
Yeah, because like they can't, or at least at the time, like the couple IMAX films I've seen, they do edit IMAX films because they have to be like 2 hours. Or at least this was back in a couple years ago. Like they don't go over. I've heard so. I don't, but I.
Well, that would be interesting to see where Cameron's film comes in then.
Oh, God. Well, no, they're going to have to. I can't imagine they're going to hold that rule. That's going to be for these films lately. You've got to have them. You can't cut out stuff. That's just wrong.
Well, did you look? Have you seen an IMAX print before?
Yeah.
Compared to the look of the regular prints?
Yeah.
I mean, not on the screen. I mean, the actual physical film.
Yes.
Yeah. It's amazing. And it's amazing how it has to be. I think it has to be temperature controlled. And
mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff that goes into that.
Yeah, very meticulous. And so I would recommend seeing that in IMAX. But it's a good, if you're a fan of the Stones, which I wasn't necessarily, I didn't dislike them.
That's probably the best concert I've ever seen is the Stones live.
Yeah, and people constantly asking them, when are you going to quit? After watching this movie, you're like, why would you quit?
Why would they ever quit? They put on a better show than anyone I've ever seen.
Mick Jagger, he is a rock god. He does not stop. I mean, he's like, if you take into account that's 2 hours of just Mick Jagger, whatever you call that chicken dance that he does. I mean, it's,
yeah.
He just goes and goes.
They are incredible. I thought it was, I'm not a fan. I do not like watching recorded concerts and any kind of, like, concert films. I'm not a big fan of them. This one I actually liked. Because there's no thrill in watching a concert that's not live. And this was, I thought, very entertaining.
Yeah. What else have you seen? Yeah, I know you've caught a couple of movies this weekend.
I caught a couple of movies. Actually, I think I probably saw one of my favorite movies of the year this weekend, Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
You know, I was talking to Chris earlier today about that, and it's been getting exceptional reviews.
And I'm actually going to talk about something else before I actually get to this. I've read so much stuff like this film was going to suck. Like over the last couple of months, people have been saying, oh, the Jude Apatow is like wearing himself thin, putting his name on too many movies, and his name is just like, it doesn't have the same punch anymore.
Right.
And I couldn't disagree more after watching this movie. I didn't expect anything from this movie, and I was like really blown away. I just could not stop laughing. I thought it was actually a good story. But you hear all this stuff on the internet, and I was taught, Will from horroryearbook.com actually brought this up a couple of weeks ago. He called me after he called into the show 2 weeks ago. And I don't know if you will agree with us on this, but we do seem to think in the last 10 years, the internet has taken some of the magic of movie going away in a sense that there's not a lot of surprise left. You hear stuff for like the last year, people, go to see the films on the festival circuit or advanced screenings, and they say, oh, you got to look out for this one. It's going to be a sleeper, or this one, this movie sucks. And there's a lot of magic of going to the movies that's definitely been taken away. Now, don't get me wrong. I like the Internet. I think it's obviously the medium of the 21st century, and it's very important.
But there's no room to discover a movie for yourself
anymore.
Yeah,
and this was just one of those cases where like, you're hearing all this stuff. You know, I read a couple of Vance reviews a month ago. They said, oh, this movie's just awful. And, you know, and nothing could be farther from the truth. It was very enjoyable. The people, everyone was laughing, which has been a long time since I've been in a movie where everyone was laughing. So, I mean, it was a really well-done movie.
Yeah. I think we have a have you been following the chat room throughout the show?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
We have a Sergeant Gemini.
Hey, Sergeant Gemini. He's posting the Stop Dr. Bowl petition website. And there's a Pro Bowl website there too. They should have a petition that says I don't give a shit either way.
That's the one I would sign if I believe in that. I just think that either petition is pretty worthless. If a guy wants to make movies, let him make movies. You know,
yeah.
Making movies. First of all, getting the financing, and I know he has a special thing in Germany where he gets a special deal or whatever because of German tax laws or whatever.
I think that's ended now, but yeah. Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, before. But, look, making a movie is a very difficult process. I don't care who you are. It's just a lot of people, a lot of money, a lot of time goes into it. And if he wants to make movies, let him make movies. It's up to you. No one is forcing you to go see these movies. There's no – I don't understand, like, how this – oh, it's an affront to humanity. These films are the worst movies ever. I'm sorry. No one's forcing you to go see them. It's like that Fanboys petition or boycott from a couple of weeks ago. It's just a waste of time. It's stupid.
Well, in that case, what was the Fanboys thing?
Not so much even. I understand the root thing of it, that they edited the Harvey Weinstein took control of the film, supposedly. Now I'm getting all this stuff on the Internet from different sources, and I don't know if any of it's true. And the version that they talked about on the show was not the version that is going to be released in theaters.
Right, yeah, because we have had them on the show.
Yeah.
And the thing that they're being accused of, Miramax, or the Weinstein company.
I think it's the Weinstein company now, yeah.
Yeah, the Weinstein company, and anyone that knows anything about Harvey knows that he has a real voice in the editing room.
Yes, he does.
And he's basically been accused of cutting the heart out of the film, which was just this little labor of love, fan-made film.
Right.
And he wants to release it on as many screens as possible. He wants it to be the next independent phenomenon. And as a result, I think he's edited a lot of the indie kind of charm out of it.
That's true. But here's what I did. The thing was, let's boycott every Weinstein movie.
Yeah, that's retarded.
That's just ridiculous.
And it's just like when people were offended by The Last Temptation of Christ from Scorsese, and they refused to see another Scorsese film. I personally, I wouldn't want to rid myself of Goodfellas and Casino, and that would be hurting me.
Yeah, it would be hurting me, Goodfellas. Anything. I just think these are not... In the world we live in, with the issues and everything, and even, you know, and there are always real issues, these are trivial at the end of the day. These are trivial things. And it's just, that life goes on or whatever, but it's just not important.
Right.
I'm sorry to say that, but it's just not important in the grand scheme of things.
Right. But we're just talking about people taking a stand against something and it really not amounting to anything.
Yeah. Kitten Fist is saying this comparison is embarrassing. I'm sure it is to you, KF.
it's all after the same thing that's meaningless.
Yeah.
I mean, so you saw Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Yes.
What was the number one film this weekend? That was
The Forbidden Kingdom.
Forbidden Kingdom.
With Jet Li and Jackie Chan.
You know, as I was going through our archive shows whenever I put together the anniversary show, we talked about that movie on our very first broadcast.
Yes, we did. God, that's how long, yeah, we, wow, that's right.
Yeah, talking about a big showdown between Jet Li and Jackie Chan, and it being directed by a guy who's only done kid movies.
And it is a kid's movie.
Is it really?
Well, not. It's better than most. Yes, I have seen this because I'm a big Jet Li and my love of Hong Kong martial arts films and all that stuff. But it has that because there's a kid at the center of the story. I guess I should say young adult as the main character, and it does have that vibe going for it. But it is nice to see the two of these guys finally be in the same movie. There is something rewarding. It is worth seeing for that.
Yeah.
If you like either of these actors, it's worth checking. It's by far the most interesting thing I've seen Jackie Chan as far as American releases go in a long time.
Well, that's good. That's good. Right,
this Kitten Fist is just raising hell in the chat room.
I know. Anyone that is interested in examining the music of the composer that we have, Michael McCormick, the one that just did our theme music for us, the website is michaelmccormickmusic.com. And please, Michael, correct me on that if I'm wrong. Or you can go to our MySpace page, and he is one of our top friends there. You can visit his MySpace page as well, and he'll have links to all of his sites on his MySpace page. So, again, we thank him again. He's classed up our show,
which we desperately
need. I haven't talked at all about the Sarasota Film Festival.
Yeah, you really should.
Yeah, and I saw a couple of stunning films there. And that leads into a great segue for our next guest who's on the line. But I wanted to mention a couple of fantastic films that I saw there and guests we're going to welcome on in future weeks. I mentioned the Darfur show that we're going to do.
Right.
We have the filmmakers for a documentary called They Turn the Desert into Fire. And we're going to dedicate the whole hour to examining their film and the situation in Darfur, which I think is important. That's something that we haven't done before in this show.
I agree.
Also Wednesday, we're welcoming the makers of a documentary called Certifiably Jonathan, which follows Jonathan Winters as he tries to get his own artwork hung in the Museum of Modern Art. It's very funny. And Jeffrey Schwartz, the director of William Castle Story, Spine Tingler, the William Castle Story. Fascinating guy in the history of cinema that we're going to examine there. And I forgot to mention. I got an email the other week. I think Dolph Lundgren wants to do our show Wednesday.
Oh, okay.
So our good old friend Dolph might come back on this Wednesday, actually. And I saw an astonishing movie called American Teen at the festival.
That's the big one.
And this is one of the most powerful, optimistic, emotional movies I've seen in quite some time. And it just follows a group of kids in their high school senior year as they're planning their future and discovering who they are. They're on their path to discovering who they are. It's very powerful stuff. And it comes out July 25th, and we're going to talk about it more on the show as the weeks go by. But this is definitely a movie that you're going to hear a lot about in the future.
Oh, definitely.
I'm hoping that it'll be a great phenomenon because it deserves it.
Is it going to get a live release?
July 25th, I think, is what the poster says.
Okay, but is that like a nationwide, you think, or is it going to be able to start out as a limited, or?
I don't know. It seems like, I don't know.
Okay.
Don't know. We'll try to get those filmmakers on, and we will ask them personally.
Okay.
But another great film that I saw at Sarasota Film Festival we're about to discuss with the filmmaker himself, and this is very exciting, because this is the first guest from the new year of Sarasota filmmakers that we're welcoming on the show this year. So, Numb tells the story of a Hollywood screenwriter who finds himself a stranger in his own life, suffering from a condition known as acute depersonalization disorder. But can true love possibly save this man? This delightful romantic comedy, which has been wooing over festival audiences across the U.S. and recently picked up the Audience Award at the Gen Art Film Festival in Chicago, stars Matthew Perry and Lynn Collins, and is written and directed by Harris Goldberg. Mr. Goldberg previously found great success as a screenwriter behind films like Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo, and The Master of Disguise. And it is a great pleasure to welcome Mr. Goldberg to our program. Let me bring him up here. Harris, are you with us?
I am with you.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. I appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me. It's a real treat.
I saw the film, as I said, I was crazy about it. I thought it was fantastic. And I can't wait to discuss it with you. But tell me first how your love of films got started, how you knew that you wanted to be a filmmaker.
Well, you know, I have an older brother whose name's Danny, and he's about 12 years older or so. And he started, I grew up just outside of Toronto, and where I lived was all the Second City guys lived within like a four-block radius. It was, you know, John Candy, and Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas and all those guys, Eugene Levy. And my brother was best friends with Ivan Reitman. when they, since they were 14, 15 years old. So they started making films in the backyard, and it just was a real, real fertile area and time. And they went on and did a film called Meatballs, which was a Canadian tax shelter deal way back when. And
that's actually, Jerry, you're particularly fond of
I'm particularly fond of all those great subversive comedies of the late 70s and early 80s. So this, we're in good hands right now.
Oh, good. Well, but it was an ironic thing because it was something that we all had gone to summer camp, and so it was all about, you know, just being at summer camp. And then Bill Murray came in at the last minute and just sort of, you know, it was his second year at SNL, and he just sort of brought this magic to it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that movie went on to do very, very well, and I sort of had this feeling of, well, if my brother can do it. And then I just really lucked out because I wrote a screenplay in college, and I came to L.A. on a two-week visit, and then I sold it and then got signed to William Morris the week after, and then I sort of went, well, this is interesting. And then he went on to do Stripes and all those movies with that they subsequently, you know, became quite successful for. And I just kind of, you know, really just fell into it, really, although I was always sort of, you know, entertainment-oriented, doing stand-up when I was young and stuff like that. So.
Right. But I did read that about you, that you sold your first script and were signed by William Morris within your first week of moving to California. I thought that was
amazing. That's incredible.
But there several years that went by before you really hit it with Deuce Bigelow, right? I mean,
well, I had when I first got here, it was during the years where, you know, it was basically the six studios, and it was a real filmmakers kind of environment where the studios were run by, you know, more like by filmmakers, and, you know, people had a real historical knowledge of film and stuff. So they would give you, you know, three or four picture deals. So off that feature that I had written, I had a three-picture deal at Disney, and I went through a period of about 7 years where I must have written about 20 studio flicks, and I kind of got into that whole thing, which was a lot of rewriting and movies that never got made and, you know, production rewrites and stuff. So I was very busy, but not particularly that happy. And it was only when I started hanging out in the Adam Sandler camp and I had met Rob Schneider that we were kind of thinking of, you know, how do you break out of this? And we wrote Deuce Bigelow sort of as a lark, something that made us laugh, as opposed to, you know, doing something that the studios wanted us to do. And when that thing, you know, became successful, it sort of changed the paradigm a little bit, because studios were going, hey, we can take, you know, sort of a B-ish kind of actor, do a film for under $20 million, and we can make a profit out of it. So that started that whole thing going. And so then I sort of started, you know, being attached to these SNL guys and, you know, pieces of talent, writing specifically for them, as opposed to sort of these general, you know, Mighty Ducks or whatever they were.
Right. I mean, that really did start a rage that, I mean, lives today, too.
Yeah, I think it changed a lot of different things, and now it's completely different. I mean, now it's a whole other world, you know.
Right. So did you always have your eye on eventually directing, or did it initially start just as you just wanted to explore writing?
No, I think I always wanted to direct, but I think I was afraid to admit it, because even back then, if you were a writer and you said you wanted to direct, they would just look at you like, you know, you're nuts, because it was such a responsible thing to do. And then over the years, you know, as I saw more and more people doing sort of these independent films and they were getting accepted and everything was changing, where studios started to buy up negative pickups, which are, for your listeners, are films that people have already, you know, produced and then they sell to the studio afterward. I started to see that there, you know, being a first-time director kind of thing wasn't such a crazy thing. So I think I always wanted to, but I had a big fear of doing it. And then when I finally did sort of, you know, do it, it was a real eye-opening experience, something that I should have done a long time ago, I think.
Well, I hear different opinions about this. I hear that from writers, directors, that, you know, directing is like going to war. It's a big battle. It's very arduous and tedious. And then I hear some people say the same thing about writing. I mean, Do you have a preference? I mean, do you find more joy in the process of writing than directing?
That's a very easy answer. Writing is hell. There's no question about it. Anybody who says writing is a joyful, fantastic experience, I would say I would like to take them in a back room and go, seriously, what do you mean? because it's very, very difficult.
Yes, it is.
I think that directing, for me, directing is a complete joy. But you have to be, it's really being sort of a therapist to 150 people, and not just the actors, but, I mean, crew members who have problems. You know, everyone's got something going on during that day, whether it be a relationship problem or a substance abuse problem or, you know, whatever it is. And you have to be the guy that has to kind of go in there and go, okay, because you have to make your day. You have to get a certain amount of pages done. And that's your bottom line. So you have to figure out a way to sort of keep the whole machine oiled and going. And
right.
if you're averse to that, I remember when I started Numb the first day, I really was quite overwhelmed by it because I saw this, you know, the 150 people staring at me, and basically quickly realized wherever I was going to go, they would follow. And if I said, okay, here's where we're going to, you know, shoot, everything would start to go. You know, lights would go up and everything. I went, oh, my God, this is ridiculous. So I realized I couldn't hem and haw, and I had to be really decisive, which was, you know, I can definitely be, but at some point when I'm the writer, I can be very indecisive. When I'm directing, you have to be very decisive. So,
well, I think too, you probably really enjoy the collaborative nature of it too.
I mean, for me, I love it. I mean, I have friends who are very, very good directors the guys who go in it who are very, you know, this is my vision and this is, you know, that, with that kind of an attitude. I think that's difficult unless you really hit it out of the park or you're a genius and there's not that many of them.
Right.
But for me, I like to be collaborative. So if a grip comes up with a great idea, or you know, an actor says, you know, I feel more comfortable saying it this way because it's more identifiable for me, or it's more organic. I mean, any way that makes the scene better, I'm all for. I love the collaborative.
And that makes sense, perfect sense, because I mean, for me, filmmaking is the ultimate collaborative art form. But then you hear from people like Woody Allen that says that he sees a pad of paper and he just wants to fill it. It's the real joy of the process comes from just writing. And I'm thinking, where does that gene come from? Not many people have that.
Yeah.
Just that eagerness to just write. So where did the idea for Numb come about?
Well, Numb was sort of something sort of screaming to come out. You know, I'd been doing, you know, years and years of these studio. I was really entrenched in the studio system. So, and that's a good thing and a bad thing. The good thing is you take it for granted that when your movies do get, you know, done, that, oh, they're going to be in 2,500 screens. Oh, they're going to have $50 million in prints and ads behind. You just assume that.
Mm.
But I was becoming sort of, I did a film called Without a Paddle, and it was a
yeah.
really, really good first few drafts that we did, and I was very proud of it. And then by the time it sort of came out, I was really disappointed in the direction that it ended up going, even though it made money and everybody considered it a success, which was nice. But I just sort of felt empty inside, and I'd had this experience that had happened to me, you know, years earlier where I, you know, I'd smoked this joint. I'd never really done drugs before. I was one of those guys. And I had a really bad experience on it. And it sort of triggered this sort of anxiety disorder thing, which I later found out was called depersonalization disorder, which really is sort of this, it was sort of this feeling of being disconnected from everything, like chronically.
Right.
So no one ever knew what it was, but I'd kind of walk around in this kind of feeling like I was watching myself or I was in a movie, and it was a really weird feeling, and it's really a defense mechanism, like a fight or flight sort of situation, so you're in a constant state of flight. And that was really, you know, pretty intense. And at that moment, I kind of met this girl, and I realized for me to make it work with this girl, I really had to change, which ironically is what's going on in my real life right now. But anyway, that's another story. But anyway, I had realized I had to change and cure myself. So I just decided I was going to write this very, very personal story more as a journalistic thing. I didn't even think it was going to get made, and I wasn't even going to show it to anyone. And,
right.
you know, my agents and managers were saying, don't do this, this is a waste of time. No one's going to care about this. So I sat down, and when I first wrote Interior, the whole thing came out in about 4 or 5 weeks. And then after I finished it, I sort of slipped it out a little bit, and I got this really weird reaction to it where people were calling me at home and actors saying I want to be in it and executives calling and saying, you know, they want to talk about their own experiences and with, you know, feeling disconnected or, you know, whatever it was. And the movie got financed within about 5 or 6 weeks, and then Matthew Perry came on board, and the whole thing just sort of came in from there. So I was really surprised how quickly it happened.
What struck me about it was that I guess I'm probably one of those guys that would have called you at that time and said, you know, I felt this way before in my life too. I had no idea there was a term for it. But that kind of disconnection that you're talking about, like you're living your life in some kind of haze almost.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was just a matter of finding a purpose that kind of alleviated that. But so I found the subject matter of your movie fascinating from the get-go. But were you writing this with any particular actor in mind? I mean, did you dream of like a Matthew Perry type playing this lead role?
No, originally I wanted Jason Schwartzman, and that's what I was sort of, you know, going toward. And then Matthew sort of called me right out of the blue and said, I want to talk to you like right now. And in Hollywood terms, that's usually like a couple of weeks. But he said, no, I mean like right now. So I went to go meet him at this restaurant, and I was a bit nervous. I wasn't really a Friends fan, but he was a big celebrity. And when I met him, he was very nervous. And then he just started telling me about his own life, and we had so many crossovers in our own life about our feelings toward, you know, our mothers, our feelings toward, like, you know, we both shared this sort of performance thing where we, you know, when we're with people, we usually act funny and charming, or try to anyway, and we're really sort of hiding sort of a more, you know, difficult underlying things. And so we really shared a lot in common. And after about 3 or 4 hours, I realized, boy, if I could get this performance out of him, and he came across as something other than Chandler, which everyone is associated with him,
mm-hmm.
I thought that would be a real coup for me and for him. And I knew he was starting Studio 60. And so we just started hanging out. And within about a week, I realized, you know what, this is the guy I want to do this. And I was really proud of him, because he really had to go places where he had never gone before and really trust me, which was really nice for a first-time director, because you know, he really just, you know, whatever I wanted to do, he would go for it or give it a shot, and I was very proud of him.
I mean, he is fantastic, and he is a sort of a kind of revelation in the role too, because we know that Matthew Perry, he has impeccable comedic timing that really comes in handy in a few of his moments in the film.
Yeah.
But the depth of this character and how committed he is to it, it really is a revelation. And I've always been a fan of Matthew Perry, so I was thankful for that performance. So he acted as executive producer on the shoot as well.
Well, yeah, I guess you know, this was one of those. As far as producing was concerned, it was an interesting situation in that we had a couple producers. One was was a very big, you know, LA producer, and we shot it up in Canada, and there was a lot of tension on that side of it, which made it difficult for me, because when we were actually shooting, there weren't a lot of producers who were on set, so a lot of obstacles or problems that a first-time director probably wouldn't be aware of, I kind of had to deal with, which was good in a way, because I realized how intense some of the things are that are outside the scope of when you're just dealing with the actors. But it was also very hard, because it doubled your, you know, the amount of work that I had to do, and things would just come up like at the last second that were just ridiculous. And you know, your brain is just going 100 miles an hour for the entire shoot. So.
But did you find once you started shooting that it was, the script was pretty much set in stone, or did it evolve at all during the shooting?
Yeah, it would evolve as far as, you know, I had such a great cast that I, when Mary Steenburgen came on, when Lynn Collins came on, Kevin Pollak, they all had a different way of working. And so I quickly realized that I had to treat each one very individually. So I took each one, you know, and we would like spend time together. And I would say, look, you know, in this scene, this is what I went through, and this is what it's about. But if there's something that's, you know, that happened to you, that you can get to that place that's a little more organic for you, I mean, let's work on that. Sometimes we would change lines, or, you know, we would, you know, change a certain, you know, things, you know, as we went along. I mean, we stuck pretty close to the script, but you know, if something, it was such a performance-oriented piece that, you know, to get the emotion out of these actors without having a ton of rehearsal, that was the main thing. So, you know, whatever I would do, I mean, I would be juggling if I had to. I mean, I would say to Matthew, remember that time you broke up with that girl? Remember how you felt and you told me about that? Well, that's what this scene's about, even though it's not really. But just remember, just think about when you broke
just
up
play
with
that.
And then, you know, if you got to that emotion, then if I got it on camera, then I'd be thrilled. So, yeah, we changed.
Yeah, it's the one thing that fascinates me about when I hear about directors talking about their work, and you said it so eloquently, like you're a therapist for 150 people, because everyone kind of needs their own approach. Some people need more talk, some people don't. I mean, what is that that period like when you're kind of acclimating to everyone's needs? Did you have the courtesy, the luxury of a rehearsal period or a getting to know you period before you shot this?
No, we actually didn't have very much rehearsal at all. The only person I got to hang out with at all for any length of time was Matthew. And what
yeah.
I would do is I would go out with him at night because he likes to go out. So we would go out, and you know there would be that sort of certain initial kind of buzz and, you know, paparazzi kind of thing that you go through. And then after that would fade down, you know, he would start to get, you know, if he got bored or he wanted to go somewhere else, whatever, he'd start to sort of, you know, get a little bit low sometimes. And I'd see him in his quiet moments and I'd just be watching him. And I would go over to him and I'd whisper, I'd say, see how you are right now? And he'd go, no, what are you talking about? I go, that's how I want you in the movie. And after we did that over and over and night after night, he started to understand, you know, cognitively what I was talking about.
Yeah.
So that's how I work with Matthew. With the other guy, with Mary, I just spent like a weekend with her, and I just asked her a million questions about her own life. You know, tell me your ups and downs and, you know, your fears and, you know, everything that you like and dislike. And then so when I got on set with her, I could kind of, you know, she felt – I had to make her feel comfortable. That's the whole thing a director needs to do.
Yeah.
If they can make their actors feel comfortable, and this is corny but safe. I mean, that's what they all say. But if you do make them feel like they can – then they'll go that extra distance for you. And so if you ask them to do something and you don't have the time to really explain it to them 100%, they'll feel like, well, he must know what he's talking about because we've had these previous conversations. I'm going to give it to him. And that's worth everything.
Well, Lynn Collins plays the object of his affection.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a revelation to me too, because I'd only previously seen her in Merchant of Venice. This is a very kind of different role for her. Another fantastic performance, and they worked off each other very well. Was there a nervousness about whether or not there'd be chemistry there? How do you manufacture? Because it's something that can be manufactured, I would think.
Well, that's a great question. Lynn was amazing in the movie, I have to say. And when she first came on, we were auditioning. I was actually surprised the level of actors that we were getting to audition for this, you know, relatively small picture. And we had all these people come on, and I could tell that, you know, Matthew kind of came on, and he kind of still had that. A lot of the actors were kind of a little bit in awe of him because of his success, because there's, you know, mm-hmm. very few guys who have that kind of stature of being on that kind of popularity, that kind of financial success, that kind of worldwide success. So they were kind of, I could tell they were kind of a little bit intimidated, which allowed him to kind of go into his comedic stuff, and that's what I didn't want to have happen. And then
right.
when Lynn showed up, she was very well trained and very very schooled in acting. And so we auditioned with this he asks her, you know, what are you looking for in a relationship? And she goes into the speech, and I asked her if she could cry in it. And when she came out and she did it, it was so powerful that when I put her with Matthew was really blown away by her, and it forced him to really act and get into areas that I knew he could do anyway, and he's probably done in the past. But she was his equal, and I
absolutely,
realized that.
Yeah.
And there was some, you know, initially there was some, you know, there people were saying, well, she's not a big enough, you know, name. We need a bigger name and all that. And I said, no, this is the girl. I'm telling you, this is the girl. This is their chemistry will pop on screen. Please trust me. And I think it did. I was really proud of her.
She is fantastic. And I think I remember seeing an interview with you I think it was a screening of Tribeca, where you talked about kind of the films that inspire you were the ones from the 60s and 70s, were there particular ones that struck a chord with you and that you used as a inspiration when you were crafting Numb?
Yeah, well, my favorite films, I've always been, I love films like The Graduate, The Heartbreak Kid, the original one. I like films where there's space involved, where the actors are allowed to, take a moment and a beat. And, I used to give this analogy, when I would do these, Q&As after these film festivals, which were great, and people would sometimes ask that question. And it sort of hit me one day that I was watching the Academy Awards, and every year they have one of those retrospectives where they show, the 100 great movies, and they have these little clips. And all they are just these moments of famous actor, Jimmy Stewart, John Wayne, whoever, and you're just on their face, the camera going in on them or whatever.
Right.
And some of the greatest moments in film are just, actors not saying anything.
True, very true.
And I miss that now. And in movies now, there's a lot of dialogue, there's a lot of quick cutting, there's a feeling like if you're not filling up the screen, and same with in screenplays, if you're not filling up the page where there's a joke literally executives will say, I want 4 jokes a page. And when you have that kind of mentality, you kind of get this kind of cookie cutter thing, and it's very difficult to get a movie that really sticks with you. And I miss that about some of those earlier films. I thought Risky Business, is one of the last films that kind of hit that. Those are the films that maintain generation after generation. And so,
yeah, we've talked about that before on the show. How that's the power of the great actor too. Is that you're in the hands of a great actor if they can hold you without saying anything.
Right.
And some of those powerful moments are a result of that, too. I'm wondering about the festival experience, because you've traveled all over with Numb, and it has to be a kind of numbing experience going from one festival to another. Tell me about that process.
Well, I personally really got off on it. I really enjoyed it, and it wasn't so much watching the movie. It was the experience afterwards in the Q&As and stuff, because I found that the film somehow resonated with people in a way that I didn't see coming, and that people would ask questions about their own lives, about their own stress, I had like people, professional people and doctors and lawyers and young girls, and they would come up and they would say, I'm going through this situation myself, whether it be panic attacks, panic disorder, anxiety problems, or whatever, and the film somehow sort of touched this chord in them, and that was the most satisfying thing I could have possibly imagined. Even beyond whether they liked the film or, about performances or whatever, this was way above that. The fact that, I remember one time there was a 14-year-old girl, and she sort of came up, and she just stood in front of me, and I said, hi, and she just gave me this big hug and started crying, and I just realized, oh, my God. And to have that one effect for that one second on that girl from this thing that I did with these people was, like, the greatest thing I could have asked for. If I didn't go through the festival circuit, I would not have experienced that, and I met an awful lot of interesting, great people through it.
Mm. And the audience that I saw it with really took it to heart as well. You could tell they're vocally entertained, but they're really touched by the subject matter as well. So, has it been picked up by a distributor yet? When can our audience expect to see it?
Yeah, I think the last I heard, it's coming out. I think sometime in May. I think I know Peace Arch picked it up, and I know it got picked up for video, and then I know I think there were like the last I heard there were like 3 or 4. Offers going out, and that's a whole other thing, by the way, is the selling of the movie. I never realized was so complicated and intense, and it gets down to sometimes it's not even about the movie; it just comes down to dollars and cents. That was a bit of a rude awakening for me, where I realized, here I am going like, but people are loving the film. Look, I'm sending emails from Chicago or wherever the film's playing, going, listen to this person, They really don't care. It just comes down to, well, will this sell here, and how much money will I make in this area, and that was a real interesting education for me. So I'm hoping everything's going to come together and that it'll get out there.
So what's on the horizon for you? Are you anxious to get back behind the director's chair?
Very much. I can't wait. I have a lot of things going on. I'm attached to a few things which I that other people have written, which I'm happy to do, and it's very hard to find a good script out there. I'm writing a number of things myself. You know, again, even though the film, I was very proud of this film, and people really are taking to it, you know, there's still, you know, your representatives, they want you to do that big hit comedy, huge idea that they can, you know, in the first weekend is going to do very, very well. So it's
right.
It's difficult once you've done a movie like this where you sort of have, you hit this kind of voice that you want to try and duplicate or at least, you know, explore, and then they want you to go and, you know, hey, go do, you know, whatever.
This massive, you know, I would think that would be a tremendous challenge, and I know that you're probably going to find yourself delving into it more and more, is to maintain that original voice that you've established.
It's very hard, and it's very difficult, and in fact, since the end of this movie, that it's been actually probably the most stressful time of my life the last couple of months because of dealing with that, where it really threw me for a loop, because for all those years, you're kind of going, oh, well, I'm the broad comedy guy, and you're just, you know, associating with those kind of people and those meetings, and that's your identity, and then suddenly it's like you're going, geez, I don't know if I want to do one of those again, but then you start to question, you know, if I don't do that, you know, what happens if I, you know, do a movie that's no one's going to go see, or it's too small, or it's too this, so that's been an interesting time that I'm kind of dealing with right now, which is, you know, I think I'll get out of it. This is going to take me all the time.
Well, when I saw Numb, I knew that it was the work. It came from a very personal place, and I think if you just follow what you feel in your heart, then you can't lose, man. And I'm looking forward to many more movies from you. And please keep me up to date about the release for Numb, and I'll keep our audience up to date. And I appreciate you coming on the show very much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. You guys are great, and this is really, really fun, and I really appreciate it as well. And hello to everyone who's listening and all that stuff.
Thank you so much, Harris.
Thank you.
You're welcome back anytime, man.
Okay, man.
Okay, bye-bye, buddy.
Okay, bye. Thank you.
It's Harris Goldberg, director of Numb, and it is a fantastic movie, and it's very nice to see these little independent movies, and they also give actors whole new opportunities as well.
Oh, definitely. I mean, just a whole other side that, you know, people, especially for, it sounds like, Matthew Perry, a side that we've never seen before. So,
yeah,
cool.
I think with the independent filmmaking movement, I think a lot more, this ties into our next segment.
Take a lot more chances.
A lot more A-list actors are paying attention because I think that they sense that those juicy roles are probably coming from those kinds of movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, we see that time and time again. I believe our next guest is on the line. Let me verify. Yes, I believe it.
Okay.
It is him. So how's everything going in the chat?
Everything's going well. Just to bring it up about actors, like taking on the character actor Richard Jenkins, and a lot of people know from Six
yes.
Feet Under.
Yes.
He's starring in a film called The Visitor. And it really gives him a chance to really show everyone what a great actor he is, not just a character actor, but an actual full-length feature, you know, leading role, and he's wonderful in it. So you're
absolutely
right.
That's a perfect example. This is a guy that has been a very established character actor, and we haven't seen him give a bad performance.
Right.
I mean, he's just one of those sturdy, dependable character actors that comes through every time out. And thanks to the independent film that he's in, he's able to kind of show the range that he has.
The same director of the movie The Station Agent, and it's just
right.
a wonderful chance to see this guy. You know, he can carry a film. It's amazing.
Yeah, and I have a sense that a lot of these great character actors can. I mean, why not? You know, and it's he is a fantastic actor, no doubt about it. I was unable to catch that movie though at the film festival.
It should be coming to you. It will be. It's making the rounds slowly. So
yeah, I keep hearing all about it. Are you ready for our third guest?
Yes, I am.
Okay, here we go. Christopher Keene is with us tonight. His new book is called "Romancing the A-List," and in it, he goes step by step, providing invaluable insights on how to nab the most bankable stars through the strength of your screenwriting. Mr. Keene is a working screenwriter himself with a series of feature films and television series to his credit. He's published novels and nonfiction works as well, including the best-selling How to Write a Selling Screenplay. and he teaches at prestigious establishments across the globe, including NYU, Harvard, and the Smithsonian Institute. Of his new book, director Michael Miner raves, Chris Keene's Romancing the A-List stands head and shoulders above a very crowded field of how-to books, while best-selling author Joseph Ambaugh says, anybody with an interest in screenwriting should read Chris Keene to learn just how it's done. It is a great pleasure to welcome Mr. Christopher Keene to our program. Mr. Keene, are you with us?
I am. How you doing, Jamie?
Hey, it's great to hear from you, Mr. Keene. Thanks so much.
Call me Chris, will you?
I'll do that, yes. I'm sorry. I was raised to say no, sir.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, I do the same thing. I just wait for people. I had a psychiatrist once who I had to call Dr. So-and-so for about 4 years until finally she said, look, you can call me by my first name. It's been 4 years, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I'll do that for you.
Great.
I'm interested to know, you know, this is usually the first question I start out with, when you knew that you wanted to be a writer, and when did you know you wanted to be a writer for the movies more specifically?
Well, when I was a kid, my parents just weren't interested in reading Google Goes to the Garage, so they just, you know, those kinds of books didn't appeal to them. So instead, they read to me from Dickens. So my whole so when I was a kid, I was the only kid I've ever met actually who had this great aspiration to be a Dickensian a character. You know, running, I saw myself as running through London, grabbing purses and snatching things, and you know, hiding out and people trying to find me. So, I mean, I got a good sense of literature, that's for sure. And they read to me, you know, taking the parts and all that stuff. And it was really, I don't remember much of it, but I know that it got in somewhere. So
yeah, it got in your bloodstream somehow.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. You know, Goo Goo Goes to the Garage. I don't know how far that would have gotten, but you know. But
you're talking about my favorite. You're talking about my favorite book there.
That,
yeah.
Oh, well, I'm sorry, man. I apologize for that. Yeah. Yeah.
So how did you get into the industry? I mean, what was your big break?
Well, the big break in the movie industry was when I just got out of college. I wrote this book. I left college and I was living down in Florida, and I had this an agent from the William Morris Agency, and I got this agent by just somebody at a party one night when I was in New York. Said, "Listen, you've written some stuff. Why don't you call? Let's see now. I know one agency. It's called the William Morris Agency." And I said, "Okay." So the next morning I called them up, and you know, the woman who answered, I said, "My name is Chris Keene. I've written a couple of things, and I think you're the only agency I really know of, and I thought I'd call you up." And she said, "Well, you got a lot of moxie. Hang on for a second." So I ended up going up to meet Joe Gold, and who's the head of the literary department in New York, and he gave me an agent, and then boom, that was it. I don't think I'd have the guts to do it today, but, you know, I mean, to do something like that. But it was, so I had an agent, and that was good. And then he moved to L.A. to be with the agency out there, and he called me up. He said, "Look, I got this guy who lives out in North Hollywood. He's a modern-day bounty hunter. He's a guy who, he has a life master in bridge. He's a classical music aficionado, and he hunts down people and throws them in the back of his trunk if he can, or puts them on airplanes and handcuffs, and he just hunts down some bad guys and brings them back dead or alive." And I said, okay. And so I went out there and lived with this guy, Ralph Thorson, and his wife and his daughter and half of the criminal element of Southern California for about a year researching the book. And then one day, the day after it came out, actually, a guy from Paramount Pictures, Mort Engelberg, called up and Steve McQueen, and he said, "Look, I think I got a picture for you. Steve was a guy who was in an old TV series called Wanted Dead or Alive, and he knew that he was dying at the time. Steve McQueen did. So,
was this the last film he did, The Hunter?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is the last one. It's a great film. It's a great swan song.
Yeah, he just wanted to kind of like close it out, I guess. That's part of it. And, you know, it was kind of amazing to hang around with this guy. I mean, I understood. I met him. Mort took the bounty hunter and me up to his suite in the Beverly Wilshire Hotel on the 11th floor. That was a private suite where Warren Beatty had his in-town suite and Jack Nicholson and McQueen, and so, you know, here's this guy that was my childhood, and I wasn't too many years out of childhood, sort of, you know, and so I'm just kind of astonished by this guy. And we walk into his place, and the first thing I see is this high-backed Victorian chair with a hole in the back of it with all the stuffing on the floor. And so I didn't just, you know, say, you know, who does your interior decorate? I mean, I didn't want to say something like that. You know, so what I did, I just sat down with him and the bounty hunter and Mort, and for about 9 hours, we took everything that we could possibly conceive of and tried to put it into some kind of a structure in the picture. And that's when I kind of learned what it takes to be the number one box office in the world, or the number one of anything. This guy's attention to detail and his focus was absolute. If someone said butterfly, he'd try to put the butterfly in the picture. If someone said, you know, brick wall, he'd try to put a brick wall. I mean, every single thing for those knives, literally, he took and tried to put in this picture. I had never seen anything like that, and, you know, very, very few times since.
You know, I'm crazy about Steve McQueen, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think part of what makes him special, I remember hearing stories about Bullitt, and there was a great big kind of back and forth scene between he and I can't remember the actor's name in Bullitt, but he basically had so much dialogue, and he ripped all the dialogue out, and he says, "I don't need any of that. Just have me eat a sandwich during this scene." it expressed so much more than pages and pages of dialogue would have. I mean, he was that strong of an actor, of a presence.
Yeah, he had a love affair with the camera like nobody else. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was interesting because we finally got around to that chair in the place, and I asked him, I said, "What's going on with the chair?" And he said, "Well, let me tell you something. We had a director up here. There was this guy named Peter Himes who was wanted to direct, and he also wanted to." And Steve said, "I got to tell you, this guy is one of the most officious, self-congratulatory creeps I've ever met." and he said, "I took him. He was sitting in that chair." And I said, "Peter, you better get up. Otherwise, I might do some harm to you." And he said, "What?" And he said, "Just stand over there by the bar." And so Peter got up and stood by the bar. And McQueen pulled this big, long hog leg .45 revolver out and actually shot the chair. And he looked over at Himes and he said, "Listen, you're fired, buddy. I would have, if I could have gotten away with it, I would have killed you, but I killed your aura. Get the hell out of here." And that's how he fired him.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I had heard just before that he had, you know, fired the director on Tom Horn by taking him out in the middle of the desert and leaving him there.
Right. No, I remember there's a documentary that came out a couple of years about McQueen on Turner Classic Movies, and yeah, there some of these stories did surface.
They don't make them like that anymore.
No, they don't.
Oh, they don't. They don't make them like that anymore, I'm telling you.
Meanwhile, you must have been intimidated as hell.
It was really heady stuff, I'll tell you. I took me down to his house, and you know, I found out how he really died too. He died from cancer, but really it was about he was a stoker in a ship in the Second World War, and all that asbestos lining got it. And then he had this Indian motorcycle collection. It was vast, and all of the exhaust systems were aligned with asbestos. So
yeah,
by the time they got to him, you know, he had no immune system left. So it was really heady stuff. And but you know, it sort of started me on this kind of character. The one big strong part, and the bounty hunter himself in the book was exactly that. He was kind of this dynamic force, and it just and everybody else sort of like came up to his speed. And that's really why I wrote this book, really, the Romancing the A-List, because you know, if you want to get into Hollywood, as far as I know, I just spent the last year out there, and I've spent a number of years out there, and you know, it just seems to me that that's what happens. The agents want a dynamic central character to show to their clients, and the managers do too, and that's what they're looking for. Because and then when the writer writes it, they've got to get that one guy down or one woman down, and what happens is that everybody else will kind of rise up and to meet that character's strength and dynamism and all that. That's what I've seen anyway.
Well, yeah, you talk about this in your book, and you argue that you know people teach different things. They say that structure is the most important, blah blah blah, but you argue that it's actually a good idea to shoot for the moon and write for an A-list actor because it forces you to up your game, and in that respect nothing is more important than character.
That's right. I mean, it's really the character is the you know, it's a funny word too, because I ask people, I ask some of the students, what do you think character is? And they say, well, it's, you know, it's how he dresses, how he, well, you know, the thing that I always say is that, character is what a person does, and how you kind of evaluate him. For instance, I read somewhere a long time ago, about, just a little situation. A doctor is driving down through Seattle, in the road through Seattle, and he's, rushing to save some other doctor's life, and, he's on his way. This doctor is a very famous doctor, and if he saves his life, which he will, because he's the only guy who can do it, he'll become a more famous than he already is, or his reputation will be enhanced. On the way, he's going about 80 miles an hour. He looks over to his right, and he sees a van with two Hispanic women in it. The van is on fire. It's burning. And this guy only has less than an hour to get to the hospital and to get this guy saved. So now he looks over to the right, and he sees these two women. And they're burning. And he knows he's a doctor, he could probably save them. But all of a sudden, that split second, he's got to make a massive, major decision about what he's going to do. And if you have four or five, and who knows? I mean, everybody has a different answer. The thing is, if he chooses, he says goodbye to the women. He says, I'm sorry, ladies, I can't do it. And he rushes forward. He basically is making a decision that shows his character. And if you have four or five of those things in a screenplay, for instance, you're going to chart the character arc of that character and see how he may, at the end, in a different situation, choose the women. In other words, he's become less, self, aggrandizing.
Right.
He wants to, he softens up. He becomes human again.
And that's absolutely a lesson that you teach in your book, that the character is defined by those series of conflicts, like how important conflict is.
Yeah, big choices.
Establishing.
Yeah, those big choices are something. I mean, it's a lot of people, the reason that everybody looks at a picture and says, hey, you know, this is so predictable, and the guy in the green button did it, and the guy in the white hat did it, you can figure these things out, because the writer overloads the decision-making process so much so on one side that there's really no choice, you know? And so it's really, you got to put them right on the edge so that they can move through the story, and you can see a transformation that happens.
Then again, I got to call you on this because I did read your book carefully, and I don't think it was all Dickens that your family was reading to you, because I think you kind of made your first discovery about character. It had to do with when your mother read you Little Red Riding Hood.
Oh yeah, yeah, she did. You know, that was funny. I was sitting there. Jeez, it was like I think it was 10. I'm somewhere in there. And I was reading Little Red Riding Hood. And she said, she walked in, she said, what are you reading? I said, Little Red Riding Hood. And she said, what's the story about? And I said, that's the name of the story is Little Red Riding Hood. It's Little Red Riding Hood. She said, well, you know, that's a little girl who shows up a couple of times, but And so she said, what do you think about the wolf? And I said, the wolf? Well, he's the evil, you know, and she said, tell me a story about the wolf. So I'm thinking, well, you know, I said, Mom, the wolf lives in this forest, and he's lonely, and he needs some companionship, and he sees a light in the forest, and he walks up, and he sees inside the house this old woman who's sitting there, and so he puts a little piece of origami on the front porch, and she comes out, and she sees it, and then she puts out some food, and all of a sudden a relationship begins. And he becomes her handyman, and they have a nice, terrific relationship. So one day she says, listen, Wolf, you got to hang out in the woods up there, because I got to my granddaughter's coming, Little Red Riding Hood's coming by. So the wolf says, sure, no problem. So he goes up in the woods, and Little Red comes in, and something happens to the wolf. He becomes obsessive. He just looks at this little girl, and he kind of falls in love. And it happens a few times, and one day the grandmother looks at the wolf, and he says, what's going on here? And the wolf says, nothing, no. He said, listen, Wolf, I'm sorry, but we can't do this. I saw the way you're looking at my granddaughter, and that's just the way it goes. We're not doing this anymore. And so and the wolf gets mad, and she gets mad, and ultimately what happens is that, he kills the grandmother and becomes the first cross-dressing wolf in history of cinema or literature. And so he waits in bed, and that's what and that's how it ends.
So what did this teach you? I mean, did it teach you that your central character is only good as the character surrounding him, or that every character is a main character in their own story?
Well, first of all, you know, it has to do with choosing who the main character is. And I just said it's Red, and it wasn't Red. It was the person who changes the most, who makes the most impact on the story, and it's obviously it's the wolf. The wolf, is the character because he's got the obsession, he's got the drive, he's got the change. And also, what happens is when you look around your cast, you find that character who does change the most, the one who's going to move the story further than anybody else is. And so what you do is you make a little check around the room, and you find out there are maybe five characters, and those five characters are all of equal this and that, but someone's going to stand out, and usually that's the characters. But in the meantime, the extra bonus in that thing is that you get to know the story from five different characters' points of view. You really look at it from each one, and so by the time you start to outline, you've got a pretty good cast and a pretty good point of view from the main characters there to formulate a pretty good story.
Yeah. So tell me what, in terms of the theme of your book, what A-list actors are looking for in a character today, and how is that perhaps different from the cinema 50 years ago?
Well, I think the characters now are obviously much more psychologically based. There's a backstory in there that's really much more dynamic and much more sort of dark and sinister sometimes. And what they have to shed today is what any story I think has is that every character who comes to into a story is facing the most critical moment of his or her life. I mean, the character has to. It's like Henry James said 150 years ago that if the main character doesn't face the most critical moment of his or her life, one that they've never faced before, then the story is just not worth telling. And so today, these characters are psychically challenged. They come from myriad problems that they've had in childhood. There's some engine that began turning way back someplace that began behavior patterns that culminated in what this character is going to do on the screen. And it's like they're carrying a big steamer trunk of hell behind you. They've been dragging this thing. It's taken their lives and turned them into hell, and that they can't get out of it. And so what the writer does is he or she presents the last chance, really, for this character to break the chains of dragging this big box behind him. And so you put you make that character so dynamic and so threatened that once they get in, they can't get out. They must keep going. I mean, it's like what happens. Yeah, I mean, that's really what the stories are today. I mean, I see it, in good pictures. They just cannot get out of the prison of their fears, basically, is what it is. I mean,
they're the kinds of roles too that that would have frightened away our stars of yesterday.
Charlton Heston wouldn't have taken something like that,
That's
right,
true.
Right.
That's
they're not afraid to be ambiguous and kind of anti-heroes in a sense,
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I mean, look at one of my favorite movies is the one that everybody else liked too is Good Will Hunting. Look at this guy.
Yeah.
I mean,
talk about that in depth in your book. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, here's a guy who is a prisoner of his own fears. He chooses to live down there in Southie Boston. He works not by chance, really, at a major university at Harvard. And he wants to look at something, but he doesn't want to be of it. So this is now he gets exposed. And so the writers did a very ingenious thing, and I think it's a really good model for other writers to take a look at. What they did is they actually looked at the Will Hunting character, and they found out where his real fear centers were, the things that were conflicted, really conflicted, his heart, his head, and his psyche. And so what they did is they assigned one character in there to actually bring that out of him. Minnie Driver brought out his heart, and Skarsgård brought out his intelligence, and then Robin Williams, as the shrink, went after his psyche, the deep, dark secret of the past. And they just went after him. He became this target, so the writers created these three characters to be like drill bits that went inside of him and pulled out the fears so that he could look at them. And so that was the kind of methodology they used, and it worked out beautifully, actually.
It's a beautiful screenplay, yeah, it really
is.
It is. Yeah, it really is.
So you teach, I mean, I'm sure you've had your fair share of teaching and workshops and different classes and things.
Sure.
Tell me about the young people writing scripts today, where their level of story sense is at, or their sense of character. Where are they winning the battle, and where are they lacking?
Well, a lot of right now, I mean, I'm here in Boston right now, in Cambridge, and I'm teaching students that, and you, I mean, it's funny. My attorney says, you know, you're out there teaching the unteachable, you know, and it's kind of funny because, but in a way, what I mean, I don't really, you know, knock them overhead. What I do is I kind of provide to them some of the stuff that we've been talking about today, and you know, let them kind of come up with their own stuff. I never like throw anything away arbitrarily. I mean, usually whatever story they tell comes out of their own stuff.
Right.
One of the questions I ask up front, which they answer with guilelessly. I mean, it's amazing to me some of the stuff that comes out. I say, you know, what is your darkest childhood memory? And they come out with stuff that just, I mean, that's what I'm looking for, really. I'm looking up the dark stuff, the stuff that would, you know, plague a character. And they're very free, and they talk to each other. These people have just met on the first day. They don't even know each other. And so it's like to come out with that kind of stuff freely brings everybody together. It becomes like a little family. And because of that, I think they're able to tell each other stuff. And they tell each other stuff that's pretty personal. And that's one of the things that I think that these people come out with, you know, but how to tell the story from a personal point of view. I mean, these conflicted people, they don't talk about themselves necessarily because, you know, it's awfully tough to write autobiography because you're always in the center and you're kind of hedging and, you know, you don't want to tell them about what you and Aunt Sally did when you were 11, you know, that kind of stuff is awful. So what they do is the things that really got into them, you know, drove home some fear, and it's all really kind of fear-based. That's what these characters that we see on the screen all have initially anyway. They've got to pull out whatever that fear is in order to deal with the problem of the movie, the thing that we can see. So I think I have students at Harvard, and I have students at Emerson, and these are two very different worlds. The Harvard kids are, 80% of them are on scholarship. And so they come from all over the world, and they're really brains. I mean, they're brainiacs. They have an extra something about them. And then the other 25% are people who come in through their fathers and mothers, et cetera. So they've been fairly privileged. So they don't have so that's two different worlds that I'm operating with. In Emerson, these students come from families that are, it's a fairly expensive college. So they're now fairly well-to-do. And what these kids have seen is their parents struggle to build whatever their businesses were, and so they really sit in the middle of these things, and they see the people that they love, their parents, really go through struggles, really start, you know, by pushing and failing, and then so they go through the same kind of thing that a character would go through in a shorter period of time, so they can understand that, and I think in that way the Emerson kids are better than the Harvard kids, but the Harvard kids bring something extra to it.
We talked about this with the previous guest too, who's a screenwriter. Isn't the most daunting task at first establishing your original voice, finding what your voice is?
Yeah.
And are these lessons really geared? I know those first four questions that you ask, one of which is, like you mentioned, the childhood memory. Isn't that all in service of discovering what your voice is as a writer?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's the voice. I mean, I think of the voice, when someone says the voice, I think of it in terms of what books are, you know, that voice. You know, mm-hmm. Toni Morrison always said that, you know, and a lot of others, that the voice is the most important thing in a book. I mean, it's the thing that, for instance, Atonement was not a very good movie, because they couldn't get the voice, or the Bonfire of the Vanity. They couldn't, you can't replicate that thing. You just can't do it. So I think the voice is almost in a movie is the sense of the fear. I think it's not just in the way you tell the story in terms of the words, but it's really the kind of paranoia or the obsession or the sense of catastrophe, stuff like that. That's really where the voice comes from. I mean, as far as I can tell in films, although every film does have a distinct voice. People say, they're all the same. Well, I said, go out and read them. I mean, you know, then you'll see that they aren't the same. These people have individual voices. I can pick up scripts and know exactly who's reading them, who's written them, without having looked at the title page. Sometimes, you know, you can really pick up those things.
Your book is called Romancing the A-List. There's actually a link to the Amazon page on our website where our listeners are on right now. It'll take you right to it if you can purchase it through there. It's a terrific book. I want to ask, because you kind of close, some of the closing parts of your book deal with it, the advice you give to a struggling screenwriter, you know, is how important is it for the screenwriter to live within the industry in L.A.?
I think it's important. I think that one of the things that everybody should do is they should go out there and spend time, because it's you make the contacts, and you can go around town, you schmooze. You meet people who are in the same position you're in. It gives you a sense of, you know, the struggle, and it gives you a sense of the success. And I know people who have gone out there, they spent 6 years, 7 years, and they come back and they're in publishing or they're in something else, but it's really, you know, you have to be there for a while just to get a sense of the place and the sense of the people. Some people are intimidated by it, and other people just kind of take it, you know, like ducks. They just love it. I mean, it just works.
Right.
But I would say if you had a chance to go out there and spend even from May until June or May until September, even if you're, you know, if you have the summer off or something, or get an internship, or just go out there and you know, Emerson has and Harvard both have big programs there, and any school does. I mean, you can virtually find some counselor who knows somebody in the schools, or even if you're not in school, I would just take the shot. I mean, you only have one life. If you sit back in a small town in Kentucky and say, I want to be a screenwriter, and you start banging away and you can't find anything, it's probably the reason why you can't. You may be talented as hell, but unless you take that chance, you gotta walk over the line. I mean, you have to. I think if you're willing to do that. It's, in New York, you don't have to do it anymore. But I think in Hollywood, because of the nature of the business, because it's a collaborative art, you really have to
go out there. I mean, I've had people tell me that, and it's true. You can't do it from, like, the East Coast. You got to go out to Los Angeles.
Yeah, just
really do. There is no other way.
Right. There is no other way.
I've been told this, and I've done it, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
We got 3 minutes remaining, and we got a caller in line. I want to make sure we get him in case he has a question for you.
Okay, sure.
615, go right ahead.
Jamie, it's Mike.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Mike.
Hey.
What's up?
Hey, I'm just enjoying the interview. You guys are talking about going for it. I'm digging it.
Go for it, man. That's it, Mike. You know, you got to get on your bike and ride out there because,
Same thing for Ubo, right?
Yeah,
well, we welcomed Uwe Boll at the top of the show. There's been quite a bit of buzz about that interview, but this is a fantastic book, and it really, I mean, go for it is a big theme in it too, and it really inspires you to get in front of that keyboard and start writing. You know,
yeah, just nuts and bolts. It's pretty simple stuff. It's just kind of laying it out there, and they're all the Hollywood stories, but the. I'm kind of a nuts and bolts guy. I just think that people should just follow some of the rules and then break them. Once you know them, break them. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. The book is called Romancing the A-List, Christopher Keene. Chris, thank you so much
for joining us
tonight.
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. Nice talking to you.
Anytime, come back on and join us. Anytime in the future. Thank you, man.
Great. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Christopher Keene, the link to his book, like I said, from Amazon, it's right there on our homepage. It's a cool little thing we have now where we can link to the product.
It is.
Mike?
Yeah.
Mike, beautiful work.
Oh, thanks, buddy. I mean, you guys had me on back when Roy Scheider passed away.
Right.
Absolutely.
You had me on there with Eric Conlander and James Gillette, and I know they're listening, so hello, guys.
Yeah, James is in the chat room.
In a weird way, I just got hooked on the show after being on there, and
well, thank you.
The guest and the stuff, and it's just I love your work, and I just wanted to give you guys something. I heard, you know, through the older shows, you guys were going on about the theme, so I wanted to get something in return.
Well, thank you. It's a beautiful piece of music.
It's gorgeous, and it is our new theme, man. And man, people are going to think we're professional now.
Yeah, I'm worried about that because I know there's people out there that's going to look. I even started humming the Electra, the William Friedkin jazz song.
Right.
But it had a good charming quality about it. But you know, I just wanted.
Oh no, no, no. You, we We love your theme. And,
it's
and like I said, you know, people are going to think we're professional until after that first minute when that theme goes off. We take over. But you've given us a real gift, my friend, and we appreciate it so much.
We really do.
Appreciate you guys. I put the theme on my MySpace.
Yeah. James mentioned that in the chat room. That's awesome.
So, give us that link. Give our listeners that link.
It's on MySpace. It's Michael McCormack Film Scores, MySpace.com/Michael McCormack Film Scores. And then I've got a separate website, MichaelMcCormackMusic.com. Shameless plug, I admit. But,
no, we plug yourself every week, man. We appreciate what you do.
Just go for it.
Folks need to listen to this show because, you guys had, like, Goldblum on. I was watching Pittsburgh earlier before the show. And that's a little, you know, not the most popular film in the world, but, man, it this show just cuts right to the people who you want to market movies to.
Yeah,
I've got all the Schrader stuff, Hardcore. I've got that in my Netflix. And
you got to call me back and tell me how you like it, man.
One. Yeah.
That's a wild one.
I have been selling Pittsburgh like nobody's business because it's just a delightful movie, and it's like Jerry you were talking about before, the ability to discover a movie without really knowing anything about it, and that's what it felt to me.
Yeah.
You know, we get to do that so rarely because everything's so hyped and marketed. But I hope you enjoy Hardcore and all those movies. You got to come back and tell us what you think of them, and I'm going to play your closing theme now. Before the show goes off the air, it's going to be preceded by a little sales thing that we have to do for GoDaddy. But we love GoDaddy, so we're happy to do it. But don't want to give the wrong impression. But your work is stunning, Mike, and we appreciate you so much.
Yeah, we really do.
Well, hey, you guys take it easy. I'm going to get out of here, but I really appreciate it. It's just an honor, and I love the show, and you know, you guys are great. Keep it up.
Thank you, buddy.
We'll
talk again soon, man.
Thanks, guys.
All right, good night.
Bye-bye, Mike. All right, that's it for this edition of Movie Geeks United. Join us Wednesday when we may or may not have Dolph Lundgren.
That's going to be awesome.
But we will definitely have other filmmakers, including the directors of certainly Certifiably Jonathan, William Castle, Spine Tingler, the William Castle story. We get it straight. And check for updates in the blogs and the bulletin postings as well. Jerry, thanks so much for another great show. And here's our closing music with a message preceding it. Thank you all so much out there in the chat room. You've been great.
Yes, thank you.
Great loyal listeners. Everyone's fantastic out there. Jerry, I'm going to call you in just a little bit, so we'll talk
about something. All right, cool.
Good night, everyone.
If you want to make an impact online, GoDaddy.com is the place to be. Domain names starting at $1.99 and complete web packages at unbeatably low prices. Best of all, if you enter the code MOVIEGEEKS upon checkout, that's MOVIEGEEKS, you'll get an extra 10% off your order. Get a piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.